So, mysterious. I want to talk, mysterious, it brings me to the question of why is theory value? Of course, a very suspicious question asked by an experimentalist, and a very dangerous question to ask in the midst of a theory institute. So, now let's say we have a phenomenon like this one depicted here. We have something that obviously is designed to obstruct our view, and we have some observations. You see, these things are correlated in their movement. Now, what theory does is, now we can say, okay, this might be due to X or to Y or to Z, different ideas. And sometimes it's very difficult to actually understand what these ideas actually would entail. So we have a theory in the sense of, can it tell us what are sort of assumptions about the underlying mechanism, what the consequences would be. You could see, and that's it. At least how I understand. Now, in particular, if these things are not intuitive, which is not in this case, I mean, it's easy to imagine different possibilities. So now it could be. So now, how does this come about? How are these things synchronized? So we have some observations, say in neuroscience. Oh, I have to put on this thing. So apparently, because in order to be recorded for posteriority, which seems to be the thing these days, for the people that come too late or don't come here to your talk, to give them a chance to ignore it, not only when it's given, but also when it's recorded. So be at least consistent. So it's possible, so the explanation for this might be something like this. That's a thought. I thought that is how it was. Of course, I had to do it. But it might be also something like this. Something maybe not so obvious. So this is, of course, illustrates the problem of trying to figure out a neuroscience or how the brain works by simply observing. Because I'm saying things that are even more obvious than obvious. How do you, what's more obvious than obvious? But it's a useful way to get into this question of which methods we need to understand something. Now, this is sort of a borderline case, because in this case, let's assume these are digital inputs and outputs. You could actually just enumerate, make a lookup table of this thing and basically completely predict or describe its behavior, meaning predict its behavior by saying, okay, I've tried all of these 10 to the 16 or so inputs, and I've recorded what happens in the output, assuming the thing is deterministic and reproducible in itself, a very dangerous thing to do, and it doesn't have any memory. Now you already made all the assumptions are probably wrong. We could describe its behavior. We could predict its behavior, and the brain has no genuine interest in understanding things, I would postulate. Now, howls of protest do not arise. Everybody is still asleep. So now, but it's true. The brain is there to control the muscle in the most intelligent way possible. And what's the most intelligent way possible is the way that benefits the...
most intelligent way possible is understanding things.
That's a matter... The question is, that may be so, but why is that so? Because all we want is to control the muscles in a way that benefit in a long, in taking the long view of things, that benefit the genes that built that brain in an optimal way. And so understanding, which we all consider something, of course we want to understand things. It's a little bit like, of course we want to have free will. But from a Darwinist perspective of the brain, it's not so obvious why understanding is useful. And I think thinking about how to figure out how to basically make it, create the prediction for a black box or for anything, there's some hints that we may get from the things we see or we come across. So let me first give a very self-serving example, and that's this case. Now this is already going into the black box of the sort of the organism by studying the retina some 50 years ago or so. Over 50 years ago, people studied the retina with electrodes, measuring spike trains generated by various cells, that so-called retinal ganglion cells, which are the source of the, if you want, are the source of the fibers that then form the optical nerve, which is the only connection between the retina and the brain. So all information that comes, all visual information has to go through the optical nerve and has to go through spike trains like this through these cells. So that's why it's interesting to record from these cells. And these cells have indeed interesting behaviors. For example, this particular cell is very sensitive to sensitive to motion, and it's sensitive to the direction of this motion. In fact, it will have a certain resting rate, which is even suppressed when there's motion in the so-called null direction. And so, I mean, we heard about this general idea of direction selectivity yesterday, and so I don't need to elaborate on this. But so for a long time, people were fighting about how it causes this, and there was all kinds of ideas. But the difficulty was that there are many things, there are many different models that are consistent with the data. That if you want, as models predict the data or predict the data, predict or fit the data, and then in many cases even predict the things that then happen to be true. Usually you have to look inside things to actually distinguish between models. This is why we take things apart. And now we come to the self-serving part. And of course, we use the two-photon microscope on the retina, not to learn anything about the retina, mind you, only to show what a great instrument it is. So now, in this case, its usefulness is given by the fact that you can use the calcium indicators, the fluorescent calcium indicators, which were then as fashionable as they're still fashionable. At the time, it was chemically synthesized ones. You can still have them and use them, but now, of course, you would use a genetic indicator in most cases. But irrespective of which type you use, you want to have something that you can excite without exciting the photoreceptors, because the photoreceptors you need to get your stimulus into the system. So you use the fact that I think that basically the nonlinear nature of two-photon absorption confines the excitation to the focal plane, and so you can record from the if you want the first layer of processing circuitry, or the early processing circuitry, which is embedded in the retina rather than being that's in some sense the circuitry that compresses the signal from whatever 100 million or so photoreceptors into a million or so fibers in the optic nerve. And so that circuitry is essential, and it's spatially separated. It actually is in the way of the light, which in itself is a bit of a mystery why you would do it this way, but that's how it looks like. So the light actually goes through these layers, which have to avoid having refractive index variations and so on. And that's where these cells are. In this case, they're so-called starburst amacrine cells. They're interneurons. That means they have no outputs outside the retina, and so they have to get their message out by manipulating the ganglion cells to have certain signals. For example, they could manipulate the ganglion cells to become direction selective, and that's what they do by being direction selective, having direction selective processes themselves. Now, this is a somewhat old and long story, long published long ago. Now, what did this story actually tell us? Now, this is here, if you measure the calcium, you actually see that the dendrites are directionally selective. If you measure the voltage with the soma, you get some oscillation, which comes from the fact that the grating you're using to stimulate in this case is periodic, but you can't really tell which direction the grating goes, and which you already could have guessed from the symmetry of the whole situation. I'm just illustrating this to ask, using this as an illustration to ask, what are functional signals good for? So what do we know after we've made these recordings? We don't know how it really works, but we know something about an intermediate, variable in the calculation. Because in the end, what we have is a calculation that takes sensory input into and recognize your grandmother, it takes sensory input in and gives you muscle activation. And so in order to understand that calculation, we can look at the intermediate results that this calculation has. And one thing in this case is that it actually has variables that give you the local motion and that direction. And we have heard more, and maybe normalized, maybe not normalized, whatever you have. But this is any model that you have of how the whole thing works would have to incorporate this idea that there's this and this intermediate result, which constrains your model building, which is a useful thing, because otherwise your imagination just goes wild. And then it becomes uninteresting, because if you can't read your models out, then you can't continue. So my claim would be, and I would be happy to have a discussion about that, that measuring activity is most useful as a tool of inspiration, of giving you ideas of how the thing might work. It's not necessarily so useful and to be the final arbiter of which of the remaining tools or models is actually implemented. And so the reason is, let me go to the next slide. So this is actually what I want to say. So you measure activity either with optical means or electrodes. It doesn't really matter how you do it. And it gives you an idea about what intermediate results there are. And you also get some idea of where these intermediate results are generated and are used. And so that gives you, in some sense, a coarse functional, if you want, circuit diagram. Because you can say, okay, the modules to do X, Y, Z are in these places. And so then we can look at the connectivity with some techniques. And so we can build our imagination. Now, but if we actually have a model that is so highly resolved, or a map, or that's so highly resolved that we can resolve each individual wire, in which case, of course, I mean each individual axon and dendrite, and see each synapse and so on. Then we can't only, then this doesn't give us, that's not only a tool to give us ideas. In fact, it may be not the right resolution to give us ideas. It is maybe way too high a resolution to give us ideas. But it is the most, or one of the most rigorous ways of testing our ideas, because we know that each idea of how this might work has to be consistent with this wiring diagram. And it has to be consistent with the wiring diagram in any single individual that it has this function implemented. And this is, so you don't have to look at 100 different individuals. You have to just look at one of them. You have to look first if they can see before you kill it. But then, or can not only see but also perform this function. So as a weeder out of bad theories. This seems like a good tool. Now, and that's the thing I really want to have a discussion about, or general agreement. So that's one. If you want a negative view of the circuit diagram, because it says it's something. It's there to disprove things. But you could also think about the circuit diagram in a way that, most electrical engineers, I think, think about their circuit diagrams. They think about ways that the circuit diagram is really a description of behavior. Now you say, we can say that's ridiculous. It's a static picture, and there's no behavior in it. It doesn't say behavior anywhere. Or maybe it says behavior anywhere, because you could say, and there's of course not enough resolution, but it could say whatever, behavior, or it could say output voltage. Now the output voltage is the behavior of an electronic circuit, so you could say, so in which way is it a description of a behavior? Because you can, if you want to simulate, or if you think of the circuit diagram as the Hamiltonian of the system. Because if I give you the voltages at all points, in fact what I really have to give you is the charges of all capacitors, because the capacitors and the currents through all inductors, because those are the only things that have memory in here. In a classic written, of course. So then the circuit diagram will allow you to calculate how this evolves in time. And so, of course, the circuit diagram is completely static, but that's the nature of the thing. I mean, you have the equations that describe the dynamics of a dynamical system as such are the equations are perfectly static, even though the state, of course, is the thing that is dynamic. Now, the other thing, I mean, and it's obvious again, but that seems to be the my theme today. So the elements, the properties of the circuit diagram, the components of the circuit diagram, of course, have to be known for this. So you can't just say the wires themselves tell you something about the topology and about the connectivity, but they alone are not sufficient to predict things. I mean, they may be able to help you when you read out theories, but it doesn't help you to predict things. For this, you actually have to understand the circuit elements properties. For example, which can be sort of interesting and complicated. Here's something from Jim Hutzbeth's lab, the electrical resonance in hair cells. It looks pretty harmless, but it actually acts like a resonator. And then similarly, the transistor properties and so on. And these, you could say that's where the value of lookup tables is, because these are sort of simple, small enough, the space of possible voltages is small enough that you can actually reasonably describe them by lookup tables. You don't necessarily have to have a go to divide them further. Right? You might divide them further for reasons and so on. So anyway, let me actually jump. Now let's talk about this. Now, practically, you could say the other way of looking at this is as description, or as a circuit diagram, being, if you want, a low or a compressed description of something. That if you have just write down the lookup table, is much larger and it takes much more memory. And so compression is a useful thing because we have all limited amount of storage. Is there other advantages? Now, because you could say, I could use other kinds of compression. For example, I could recognize that this is a regular pattern and can encode this in very, very efficiently. And then I would capture, in fact, this is really simple circuit, so you just capture the rest of the thing except for this point down here, which of course is generated by this part of the circuit. Now, so reconstructing the circuit not only gives you compression, which you could get another way, but it also may point you towards things that deal with rare cases. In this case, you have one exception. Do this, except if all inputs are one, then do something different. And that is reminiscent of things that people have described. cells that have very, if you want, sparse receptive fields, they only react to Bill Clinton, and so on. So now all this is, again, nothing terribly new, but it's sort of good to remind myself. So this was, of course, not lost on earlier generations of neuroscientists. I mean, you could say it goes back all the way to the great anatomist, Ramon Cajal. Now, which is maybe the point of where I should talk about my title. Not my titles, but the title of my talk. So the title of my talk is something structural neurobiology.
No, structural biology.
It says only structural biology? Okay, I meant it to mean structural neurobiology, but it's fine. So structural biology. So now I propose to make structural neurobiology one of the most important subdisciplines of structural biology. Now again, howls of protest from people not here, and so they don't need to know that they have to howl. Now, why do I like this term for what is normally called neuroanatomy? Now, neuroanatomy sounds, except to the neuroanatomist, somewhat old-fashioned, and oh, it's like, okay, I did all these exciting experiments. Oh, did I? I hope I didn't forget to inject whatever biotin in my cell so I can recover it and get its shape also. It sort of seems often like an afterthought in a physiology experiment. And the reason is that in its somewhat sampling and incomplete form, this is sort of more something that was maybe more relevant to say 10, 15 years ago, but it's still, in its incomplete form, anatomy is important as a sort of supplement, if you want, supplementary information or supporting information for the experiment I did, but it didn't have in it, if you just have a few cells reconstructed here and there, it doesn't allow you to draw very firm conclusions. But if you have all of the cells, or for example, if you go to the example, take the example of an enzyme. Now the enzyme, most enzymes are proteins, except those that use RNA or have, I mean, so you could say, okay, I have the information about this few of the amino acids or so. That's fine, it's going to be useful, but if you have the structure, the whole atomically resourced structure of an enzyme, that has to be. Then it puts enormous constraints on the functional mechanism. If you say this enzyme works in this particular way, any idea has to be consistent with its structure. And I think similarly, if you look at the structure of the brain, any idea has to be consistent with the structure of the brain. And consistent, and the constraints become ever more sort of. The definitive, the better the resolution. And this, of course, wasn't lost on, as I said, and that's sort of parenthesis closed about naming of things. So I wasn't lost on for earlier generations, and it was particularly obvious from the beginning that electron microscopy was the way to go. And so the one paper that actually already was mentioned yesterday in the context of C. elegans behavior, the circuit diagram. And that paper has been used, and then it's sort of uses evidence for and against the usefulness of circuit diagrams. Now, this is maybe the point to say something about generating maps. And I had some discussions with Haim yesterday and today about this. And I'm sure I will misrepresent him or what he's thinking, but he's here, so he can correct me where I'm wrong. And I'm not saying if I'm wrong. So maps are generally, maps is a thankless task, I would say, because without maps, you won't go anywhere, and once you have the map, you forget that you have it. You just assume it's sort of there automatically. But there's something. So that's just the map maker complaining about being underappreciated. But that's not really a serious worry that one would have to have. But there's another danger in that. Because making a map, in some sense, runs counter to the to our idea of how we should do science. Because the idea of how we should do science is start from a question, and then think about it, and then have some ideas about how it might work, how the answer to the question could be. And then say, okay, we have to do this and this and this experiment, and the outcome of these very specific experiments will tell us whether this idea is consistent with reality. So everything goes even more rigorously. You always just try to disprove your idea. So now making a map is sort of exactly the other direction. You say, I have no idea how any of this works, and I don't even want to hear anything about it. I just make a map, and that will be the thing that everybody will use to figure out everything. And so it obscures the thinking, or obscures the idea, or it lulls you maybe in the idea that making a map, which can be a lot of effort, is already enough to have any scientific insight. By itself, of course, it doesn't give you any insight. It's just something that helps other people. And it's, if you want, the speculative execution of many targeted experiments in parallel. Yeah, and so you're doing, because of it's in some sense a purely, could say it's purely an efficiency argument, because if you, for each particular question which gives you a particular prediction or a particular theory about how a particular phenomenon, for example computation, works, it gives you a sort of detailed prediction about how the circuitry or some neurons in one part of the brain are connected to neurons in the other part of the brain. And you're only interested in these neurons for this particular question. So you could do this experiment with some viruses, or if you have unlimited resources, you could do this experiment, of course, with electron microscopy. And for the next question, if you do it by electron microscopy, of course, the next time you do this experiment, you have a question that about a different circuit, but in the same species of brain, you have to do the whole thing over and over again. And so you see, okay, so maybe it's efficient to do this once for all, and then everybody just do successive experiments if you want, by sort of virtual experiments or a virtual solo, yeah, by asking the database. I mean, similar to the genome, where you of course have ideas and you need to look them up. So nothing new. So in some ways you could say problem solved. Let's make maps of the nervous system and use them once they're available, and then it's a purely technical problem. And in some ways it's a purely technical problem. But if technical problems are interesting enough, we still like to hear about that. Maybe that's, anyway. Okay, so the problem of making circuit diagrams of whole brains with electron microscopy, with anything for that matter, is a question of that you have to have at the same time high resolution, and you need a large field of view. Take the extreme case of wanting to have a whole primate brain. You still have to resolve your individual vesicle, so you need something like 10 nanometer resolution. And you have to do this over 10 centimeters, and that is how many orders of magnitude. I mean, anyway, so that's really the problem. And so you need a large field of view, or you need something to stitch things together, or and so on. And so to remind you, we heard about this yesterday. So that's how the worm was done, and how a lot of interestingly. And now still a lot of connectomics or a lot of circuit diagram reconstruction studies, and I'll talk about that. So it's basically taking serial sections and then tracing the individual things through them. And that task has become much easier by using computers to align them and to trace these things. And computers have gotten pretty good at this. Now, not being from that, not knowing really that much about computers, but knowing something about microscopy, our approach was to put that process, sort of put the cart before the horse, or finally put the cart behind the horse. I mean, and it's really an open question, and it's a little bit like the chicken and egg question in this case. Do you want to image your section before you cut it off or after you cut it off? And there are arguments for both. Actually, there's really a few arguments for imaging it afterwards, but in practice, that still has lots of advantages, and I'll get into that. Now, this has the advantage that it gives you aligned data stacks and gives you thinner sections, and we'll get to that also. Now, this is an example, but let's get to the some technical details. So, first thing is to remember that unlike the much sort of talked about cryo-electron microscopy, which maybe we'll get to at the end, the electron microscopy of neural tissues or tissues in general is performed by heavily staining with heavy atoms. Now, why do we need heavy atoms? We don't really need heavy atoms. The weight, because since we're not imaging with gravitons or something like that, that would be affected by the mass of the atom, the heaviness is not important, but the charge is important. And atomic nuclei come only in, if you want heavily charged, you also get heavy. So heavy atoms it is. And so what we really need, of course, is heavily charged atoms, which then are very effective in affecting or scattering electrons. And because all the atoms that make up tissue normally are all sort of in a very narrow range of nuclear masses, with say the exception of hydrogen, but that's sort of sitting on the side anyway. So you can get some contrast, but if you want real good contrast, you use uranium, even osmium, lead, maybe iron occasionally. And then whether you look at something in reflection or in transmission doesn't really matter. It turns out it matters in a different respect. It doesn't matter. You can get contrast. In both cases, the contrast is reversed. So now let's talk about the disadvantages of this method. Now, in this case, since you're getting, in each sort of go, you get a two-dimensional image. And now you have to make sure that this two-dimensional image only contains information from the layer you're interested in. Because in the end, of course, you want a three-dimensional image. But since there's no method, I mean, you could do tomography, and it's something that you could in fact do. And with electrons, you can't do tomography of sort of things that like the size of a whole brain, because the electrons won't make it through it. But you can do tomography with X-rays, and some people are actually trying this. And it's possible that you could go with X-rays to high enough resolution that you can forget about the whole electron business, which would be just as well. So you could say, whether I make a transmitted electron microscope or a reflected electron microscope isn't that much of a difference. In one case, I just have an optical system down there, and here I would have to have a beam splitter of sorts, which already is non-trivial, but then I could image this on the detector. Now, it turns out that that's not possible. And so the reason it's not possible is that the scattered electrons, or whether they're scattered or secondary electrons, they come out in, they have a relative, certainly a wide angle range and a relatively broad energy range. And while in some sense the success of Kahal was based on the fact that people had figured out by the end of the 19th century how to build optical lenses, microscope lenses, that are both high numerical aperture and optically corrected for monochromatic aberrations and also for to some extent for chromatic aberrations. Now, for the electron microscope, we can do this for very sort of narrow numerical apertures. Now, there, for example, for the longest time, you couldn't even get rid of the spherical aberration in a very narrow beam. Now you can, but you can't do this in a way that allows you to effectively capture a large number of electrons scattered over a large number of a large angle. So. Now that's to the rescue comes the scanning microscope, which we've already encountered in form of the two-photon microscope. And the two-photon microscope does something not dissimilar when you're imaging deep in tissue, your detector will not be spatially resolving, and that's a good thing in that case. You do it because the fact that the fluorescent photons are scattered on the way out of the tissue, but the point is still that if your excitation spot is well enough defined, you can get perfectly good images, albeit one pixel at a time, if you sort of raster the thing. Now the disadvantage, of course, is one pixel at a time, so everything is slower if you want by this factor of the number of image pixels divided by whatever time it takes. Now if you had if you can take a full field image, you can image much faster than if you take a rastered image. And so that's one of the reasons why it's still true that most of the big data sets in connectomics are actually taken by using transmission electron microscopy because it's much faster. But I go through that. I come to that. Say a little bit more in a bit. So anyway, so if somebody figures out how to correct electrons, correct electron imaging at high numerical aperture with good chromatic correction, let me know. I will put you on the paper. So now let's talk about the different methods. Now the this is in something where it all started. This is how I did all, and Sidney Brenner's group at the MRC in Cambridge. They used the serial sectioning of the worm. And so the technical advances there are twofold. I mean, you already mentioned the computers that allow you to align the things, but you also had to be a little bit faster. And for that, Clay Reed's group, and in particular Davi Block, sort of worked on this build the camera array and imaged larger areas and did this all very fast. And so the crowning, I mean, the achievement or a very significant achievement recently published was the 3D imaging of a whole Drosophila brain. So something you could say that's the next milestone. We had the C. elegans with 500 neurons. Now we have the Drosophila brain with about 100,000 neurons. And of course, you could now extrapolate to the elephant brain or the blue whale brain or the human brain, just using these two points, and then this we get something like 2060 or something like that. or anyway, so but we won't take that too seriously. So now the other method shown here all depend on reflection imaging, also so scanning imaging, and they're different so if you go from here to here, we have we still have sections, but we collect them on a solid substrate, which means you can automate the collection of the sections with some mechanism, the atom technique, and then look at them in a scanning electron microscope. Or one could do we could stick with the knife, but look at the block face, or we could say, okay, let's get rid of the knife, this is nothing but trouble, and somebody might cut themselves, so I use an iron beam. And that's the technique with so this is the focused iron beam that uses gallium ions, and which to date, this gives you the best images. But it has a field of view problem, and we'll talk about this for a moment. So now let's compare these techniques.
Wait, what the field of view problem is for the range of cutting, right? Not the range of imaging. That's the point you're going to bring up.
Yeah, it's for the range of cutting, but if you can't cut,
yeah,
you can't image. If it doesn't fit, you can't convict. Anyway. So if you can't cut, so now why is the cutting? But anyway, so the big, okay, so let's first talk about, let's start from over here and then build up the suspense. So the lateral resolution of the transmission electron microscope is still better than any of the other techniques. But at some point, once you can see your wires and your vesicles and so on, you say, so because you could do this at 2 nanometer resolution. Now, but if you then go in the Z direction, meaning sort of because that now you have a sampling problem, because each image is basically a projection of a thickness of the slice, and so if the slice is 80 nanometers thick, that's the resolution you have. So since it's very difficult to cut these serial sections below 30, maybe even below 40 nanometers, that's the resolution you get. Now the atom, because it's automated and so on, has a bit better resolution in the Z direction, as you can already see. Now the knife-based serial block phase imaging is about the same in the Z resolution, maybe a little better, but it crops out at around 20 nanometers. And this goes down to 4 nanometers or so if you want. Now you do have one problem that, and we'll get to that in a bit, that the Z resolution doesn't only depend on the sampling thickness. I mean, as if you do electrophysiology, if you have a pre-filter that filters your data at 3 kilohertz, record them at 300 kilohertz, doesn't buy you anything. So you have to make sure that the signal is actually confined or reasonably confined to the slice here.
So Winfried, what's the problem with cutting in sections for transmission? Is it a material problem? Problem with the plastic? Where does the effort need to be to cut there?
I mean, I think it's the first. Now, the curvature of the knife edge will play a role. Eventually, the knife is not sharp enough. And then the integrity of the section, because remember, you not only have to remove the material, but you also have to handle it. Now, you could say in this case, you don't have to handle it because you only have to remove it. That's why this is a little bit better than this. But then you have the problem that there's instabilities in cutting, because as you cut it, it's sort of, if you particularly thin, you'll get oscillations because you sort of dig into the surface and then you come back out and things like that. And so in practice, nobody has, I mean, there are people under certain circumstances, if you cut the XTM metal surface, you can cut them at below 10 nanometers, but for biological samples, it's difficult. There's another thing that's particularly affects this technique under, unfortunately, it's the fact that that the electron irradiation itself makes the sort of cross-links the material on the basis of, for example, electron resist materials, and so it makes the cutting then makes the cutting more problematic. And so this, I think the limit is a section sort of handling problem. This is a cutting problem itself, and it's possible that one could find polymers or whatever that would allow you to cut thinner. But in some ways, that has become less relevant now, and you will see that towards the end of my talk, it's come because the ion beam technology has now it has a solution. Now the focused ion beam technology has this problem. So why is it limited in the field of view? So the way the focused ion beam technology works is you're basically shooting a beam tangentially over the sample. So the ion beam actually, so that in some ways, the sample self shadows. You can also put a layer of platinum at the end that distorts the beam. So what happens now? It's sort of like, so the ions now fly over the sample a long distance, or have to fly over the sample until they hit something. And so at first this works pretty well, but as you go sort of 20, 30, 40 microns into the sample, there's first of all, of course, the problem is you have to have a long confocal distance. But also, because you're flying over the sample at such a very low height, if there's some charge variation in the sample, it will give you an accumulated deflection of that beam. And so if you actually look at how the rear edge of that sample looks like, it's the front edge will be very, very flat. The rear edge could go like this. Maybe there's a curtaining effect. So that's where it's not a hard limit. It's sort of a question of how much can you tolerate and how much can you compensate for and so on. So now there is a way to get around this, which I will also get to. Now, this is just things to remind me of all these things, which I really want to get to this slide. And I've sort of advertised it, so I'll just briefly mention it again. You need to have an information depth that is consistent with the cutting thickness. So if you use, for example, 7 kilovolt electrons, they sample over too large a depth because you're cutting at, say, 20. You don't want to have this information before you get to the slice. Now, 3 kilovolts is better. Optimal is about 1.5. There's a certain problem with detectability. And so, anyway, so that's... Now, why not use even lower voltages? The problem is that eventually you lose contrast. You lose elemental contrast. And the reason is that as the energies of the electrons get smaller and smaller, they no longer really sample the core region of the atom. If you want, the wavelength is too long, they sort of they don't care about things as small as the inner part of the atom. So that's why, say, here you still have already have a reduction. Going even further down is not useful. Okay, so another problem that we have is the problem of charging. Now, even though the samples are stained heavily with heavy metals, and so heavily, I explained why you don't have heavy metals. Now, I haven't explained or made a point out of heavily staining. So one problem you have is that as your resolution goes up, the staining density you need goes up with the inverse volume of the voxel size, because you have to have, say, a few of your whatever you stain it with per voxel. Because if you have one here and the next is 10 voxels over, there's really no point in imaging those intermediate voxels. I mean, you need it for resolution, but then you could also do just determine the location of this one thing you're imaging and then go to the next, find the next one. you have to have it heavily stained. So a lot of, which in itself can be a problem. But even if it's heavily stained, then it still may not be conducting. And then you get things that lead to distortions of signal and space, and you have to deal with that. There are now methods to deal with, so I don't want to dwell on it, but it's something that is a problem. Technical problems that needed to be solved, and then nobody's interested in. Story of my life. So, okay, let's now go to some, let's call it fake biology. No, it's not really fake biology. It's real biology, but the question is, I'm going to return to this question of directional selectivity, and I'll tell you. So there is, we heard yesterday from Mitya Shosky's talk about how the connectivity is important to get the directional selectivity in the first place. But I want to talk about the next stage. So once the directional selectivity is established as a property of axon of dendrites of the starburst immigrant cell, now that information has to be sort of sold to the next level, or it has to be distributed, given to the next level in a way that doesn't dilute it and preserve its character. And for this, we combined a two-photon microscope. Have I mentioned the two-photon microscope? And Kevin combined three things. First of all, a technique that he and Thomas Euler, who did the dendritic imaging experiment by electroporating, basically, they wanted to stain all the cells. And so if you stain cells one at a time with an electrode, that is very tedious. If you want to stain all the cells, not to speak of impossible. So if you put sort of go like Frankenstein and put some electrodes that are above and below the retina, and then you put the dye in there, and then you go chump, and with just the right amount of voltage and duration, you make transient holes in the cells that let the dye in, but don't kill the cells yet quite. And then you get something like that. So this is now in the ganglion cell layer. You can see a blood vessel, which is a useful thing later, because it allows you to find this place again. I'll see that. And then you can look at the properties of individual cells by using various stimuli and so on. And then you find the direction selective ganglion cells. Surprise, surprise. No. Now they've been renowned, but then you always happy to see old people that you've known from your childhood. So now that is the whole thing as a movie. So this is this little arrow on top. That's the direction of the moving stimulus. And if you look closely, the different stimulus directions will stimulate different cells, which means that we know now, for if we keep track of where we are and go to an electron microscope, we can now identify the directional preference of these cells. So now we go in there, and now the scale problem that I mentioned before comes to the fore again. As we start from a cell body and then trace all the connection, trace the wires. And so at first, okay, this is fun looking, following this wire, like adventure as a Boy Scout or whatever, tracing something, but after a while it becomes tedious. And then you say, why can't the computer do this? And bear with me, you'll see how the computer does this. And this is done by hand. So the cell is, now we already know the cell is direction selective, and here we find it still looks like, the cells still look like they're bistratified. There's two layers in the retina, one that is mostly or almost exclusively handles one, 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 but on responses and off responses. And so now we have, and then we have to add the whole, we have to add all the star wheel cells. And so then we do this, and then I have a volume where we have something like 8 or so ganglion cells and something like 27 or so starburst cells. And then we find that from a perspective of the starburst cell, the output cell, its direction selectivity depends on the direction of the dendrite. Now, but I want to actually only talk about one thing. This has also been published a while ago. I want one thing that will be relevant for the way I want to end today, and which is this. Now, we find a certain circuit diagram, and we can say, okay, we are now very satisfied because we can use it to tell which of our theory friends is smart and which one isn't so smart, because we can tell the right theories from the wrong theories. But aside from that, the question is, and remains in this situation, how was this thing built? Because it's not like you have a big blueprint and then there just somebody goes and wires, solders this together, or uses some fancy technique, as we make our printed circuits with masks that basically are just maps of the final state we want. No. This has to come out from through a developmental process where a bunch of genes make a bunch of proteins, and they then end up creating a circuit diagram. And so one of the questions that is one of the things you can use to make specific connections between two cells is to say, okay, these two cell types, whenever their processes get close to each other, they will make a connection. So the connection is, it requires proximity and cell type. And it's sometimes called Peter's rule. It's often violated, but it's one way, roughly, where you have, which we can talk about this or that. But it could be, so if you had only, if that was the only mechanism at work here. So two cells are either want to make connections or they don't want to make connections. So, which is easy to imagine, because you can easily imagine the cells making proteins that like each other, and therefore trigger synapse formation. Now, and this type of connectivity would in fact be consistent with that, because it could be that say, this cell somehow, by being downstream from this, there's a gradient or so that this cell expresses different something molecules that then make this cell generally less receptive to synapses, or to less likely to synapse into the cell. And that would be fine, because you would find no connections here and a lot of connections here, which would preserve the direction information. But now, if you look at the cells that are a beam, now if this was mainly a question of the cell identity, we would either have many connections in the whole overlap area, or we have no connections. But here, if you find this, then this can't be a property of these cells, because these dendrites here are just as much properties of the cell, part of the cell, as these dendrites. So if you find this, then we have a mechanism of wiring that is specific for the dendrite. I mean, I'm using, in this case, in a very sloppy way, the word dendrite, because these dendrites are actually also axons, in the sense that for the starburst endocrine cells, the dendrites contain both incoming and outgoing synapses. And so, anyway, just keep that in mind. So.
Can I just make sure I understand? So the direction selectivity is local. So what really matters for the ganglion cell is the local angle of the dendrite of the starburst cell. Now, right. If the SOMA are at a distance, and if I just assume they will connect kind of randomly, there will be
some bias in the angle of the dendrites. And what you're saying is that there is more bias than this. So there's some local rule that we prefer some local angle of the dendrites.
Okay, I'm glad you asked the question. So it could depend only on this angle,
yeah,
or on this angle.
Right. So
the question is, does it only depend on the relative position of the two somata,
exactly,
or does it depend on the angle of the dendrite, of the dendritic branch to the null direction of the cell? And if you, as from an engineering point, this is preferable because this collects because these have a different. They're sort of helpful for this. They are not helpful. And so you want this, but it's possible that you could only get this. I mean, this would still work, but it would be slightly less efficient. So the question, what is it?
So what's the answer?
If you had read the paper. Okay. So the answer is here, of course. Would I ask him a question that I don't know the answer to? Foolishly, I guess, sometimes. Anyway, so this is, again, these areas. So it turns out that the synapses actually have a very clear bias towards the answer that says, that predicts that the connectivity is specific for the dendritic branch and not only for the cell. In fact, next. This is sort of the area in which, if you wanted ideal connectivity, this area would be connected. This area completely did not connect. So these are counterproductive, but they're the minority, the suppressed minority, or not sufficiently suppressed minority. We still have protesters on the street. Now, if you look at the only proximities, only points where the cells get close to each other, you find that there's no asymmetry here, which shows you that this is really a relatively specific mechanism. So this now is an example of an experiment that is not map-making, because that's an experiment where we very specifically tried to answer a particular question, and we did the EM reconstruction only with that question in mind. Now, other people have used the same data set for other things, but there were decisions made about how to search for this data set that make it more difficult to use it for in general. So now I'm going to go to what I would call connectomics, which is the ambition to do everything and learn nothing.
Do you know what the mechanism is for this?
For the connectivity?
Yeah.
No, we don't. Do I look like a developmental biologist? No, I mean...
Do you have some guess of how...
Okay, so I actually don't know. So the interesting thing is, and I sort of, this has been a while, so I've not followed this in detail. I think Josh Sainz might have to say more about this, because he's been studying the wiring of the retina. And so we don't know, but this is something to be curious about. I am curious about it, but I'm not curious enough to learn all the things that would get me out of my... I don't think I could actually have an unfair advantage in the next stage of this process, because that requires a very different skill set from mine. So I've moved on to things that I was under the illusion. And here's Moritz Helmstetter, a very young Moritz. He did the connectomics of a smaller piece of the retina, but more complete. Now, what did we learn? I just told you, we didn't learn anything, but I guess I spoke too soon or too... Anyway. So one thing one can do, which is at first an exercise in seeing whether you find the same thing that other people felt. So do I actually, that's what I see, that's the map maker. So in this case, we reconstructed all the bipolar cells, which are very small, and therefore most of them, or a large fraction of them, are completely contained. So they have The axons are up here, the dendrites are down here, the photoreceptors make contacts here. And they're distinguished mostly by the depths where the axon. I got it completely wrong. This is how if things look unconscious. So the axons are up there, the dendrites are up there, the axons are down here. So these are the outputs. Okay, thank you. So these are the outputs. The photoreceptors come in from. Now that's not tall enough to make the photoreceptors up there. So anyway, so this is the layer. This is the dividing layer between on and off. And let's see the. Where should they be? So anyway, we'll see that. Okay, so now we can look for the types, and we find all of the types that people have described before, and there's an additional type here which we still don't know what it does. We call it X, as in unknown, as in the X files. And so now, and one thing that this data set taught us is the value of, rather than statistically labeling these cells and doing this on many retinas, which of course you can do and people have done to find this thing in the first place, taking all the cells in a dense region, you know you're getting all the types. And you get a much more precise appreciation or much more precise measurement of their relative positions. And this is again important if you now look at if you look at development, because one thing you can think about retinal development is sort of the layers play an enormous role. There you are. Because then now you can have gradients along the layers, and then you can make decisions about connections depending on depth.
Can I ask you, it's a question that is very relevant to some models we're doing. This suggests that any ganglion cell type will get inputs from at most two or three bipolar cell types. So is this correct?
Why would just by?
Because of the layering.
Yeah, but some of the ganglions are actually
bilayered. Yeah.
No, or some of them are actually very, very, they're very different types.
So do you know of the 30 or 50 types of ganglion cell, like what's the, how many different cell input, different bipolar cell type inputs they get? Kind of what's the dispersion?
I don't know about that paper though. So okay. So first of all, this paper doesn't contain all the ganglion cells. But for the ganglion cells we found and could identify, we know which. Okay, so again, this in some ways, that paper only looked for contacts. It didn't look for synapses as such. So there's a little bit of a missing information. But so this is now being slowly filled in for by other groups. Now, so we do have that information in principle, but not as well as you might want it in individual cases. So next thing. Okay, so this talked about the position. We can map the distribution of depths and so on and draw all kinds of conclusions from that. So now I want to come to the question of computers. Now early on we thought, okay, computers must be helpful. They have helped so many other people. They must help us. And in some ways, you could say, if there ever was an easy machine vision problem, it's this. Because the input is not cats and dogs and so on, but it's things that all look very, have a very, if you want, narrow spectrum of visual texture. Now, that could be considered a disadvantage because you have now, of course, you don't have that as many things to look at, but it also means that you can sort of feel sort of completely classified because you only need to classify things in and out, or all you have to do is find the surface of cells to then reconstruct the wires. And it worked sort of, early attempts, I mean, it worked well enough that it actually sort of saved us a lot of work. It saved us about a factor of 100 of work. And so what did it save us? So now it didn't save us the work to get sort of if you want, what we call the skeleton. So we needed to have a method, which we did by having lots of undergraduates to trace these things on computer screens. Basically, we needed to have something that tells us that this part is connected to this part. But we didn't, but we had information after we did sort of the various steps of this machine learning plus other thing, aggregation and segmentation of the process. We sort of knew that if this point in the middle or this point belongs to a particular cell, the computer told us that there's a whole region that also belongs to the cell. Now, what the computer didn't do, it occasionally made the mistake that it didn't know that this thing was connected to this thing. But then you look back at this and say, okay, this tells us this point is connected to this one. And if you take these 2 points, so we might as well combine this into a three-dimensional model. Now, I shouldn't say three-dimensional model, but a volume model. So this now gives us all the locations that are inside the cell. Now, that allows us now to determine which other cells this cell touches. And since touching is a sort of matter of definition at that level, because of course if there's a nanometer of whatever in between the cells, do they still touch? And I would say in general, touch in the sense that there could be a synapse. So that distance, they get close enough over a large enough area that they actually it's likely to have a synapse. And so for this we need a volume model, and then we have all the contacts, and then we get the matrix.
So you don't see vesicles here.
In this particular case, what we did is we got rid of the vesicles because we had not enough trust in our friends from the computer science department. Because we said, okay, well, let's make it so easy as possible. We used the stain that selectively stained the surface of the cell and took out all the intracellular stuff. Now that turns out then becomes difficult to identify synapses, becomes easier to trace the virus. Now all of this has been rectified, trust has been restored, and we give them the dirtiest samples possible with every mitochondria, every vesicle stain, and they can still follow the virus. And they still can then discover, map the synapses. So everything is well now. In this case, this is only a contact map. So it's not a synaptic map. It tells you where there is no contacts, where there are no synapses, because the synapses depend on contacts, but not on these contacts.
What is the definition of contact? What is the distance?
You can define. Once you have the geometry, you make your own definition. You sort of,
what is your
definition? I don't remember. Some reasonable, say 10.
It's
10, 10.
Peter's law. It's again Peter's law in this case.
It is Peter's law at a nanometer scale. Yeah. So this is clearly unsatisfactory in the end, and I think clearly one needs better, but one gets better now. So this is, since this is in something more a historical account, now you could say, okay, we want to respect the individuality of each cell, or you could say we only care about which group it belongs to. And then you can condense this matrix to this matrix, which is now ordered by cell types, and all the cells are pooled. And now this is a cell-cell connectivity matrix, and then you can, depending on your theory that you're pursuing, you can look up whether the connections you predict are there or not.
So what do you mean by connectivity between ganglion cell types of different ganglion cells of different types?
Now, different ganglion cells. Okay, so in this case, of course, since this is only the ganglion cells are presumably synapses. Now, the ganglion cells, I think, are up there. Yeah, let's see, where is the matrix? So I forget.
In the file, even in the previous plot, you had some dots.
Okay, so that reflects simply the fact that ganglion cell dendrites will touch it occasionally. This, as I said, this is just the contact. It's not the synapses.
Yeah, but then how can I trust the other ones?
You cannot trust the ones. You can only trust the zeros.
Yeah, but
So what do you mean by cell type here? Or what is the definition of cell types in this case?
I mean, cell types as defined by... it's a morphological definition. So in the retina, of course, there's this particular situation there. The cell types are, some cell types actually tile the retina. So the territories of their axons, for example, of the basal cell axons will overlap only little. So that's one way to sort of distinguish cell types, and so on. But because every location needs, in some sense, the full complement of cell types. In cortex, that question is a little bit trickier. And you could, of course, say, if I index the cell type by location and say this is a different cell type, if it's at a different location, then every cell has its own cell type. But in many situations, like in the question of connectivity, you do sort of, the information carries over from one cell type to another. You have the equivalent cell types, you find sort of correlated connectivity. Okay. Now let me run through a little bit more, just in some sense, just to introduce the people involved, and a little bit about sort of the variety of biology. And this is not a bird. So, now we like the bird because we have some of our best friends are bird song researchers, and we like the bird because there's very few other behaviors that can be as precisely measured and quantified and few other behaviors that are as repeatable. In their natural state. It's not something you can probably train a monkey or a rat or a graduate student to do something in a very repeatable way, but that may be not the natural state. But in this case, that's what the birds do. They these various repeatable sing the songs. And so and some of these questions are actually connectivity questions, or in the end, what always comes, it always is the most system neuroscience questions are connectivity questions. And so one of the most prominent discoveries in that field was the discovery of having cells in this part of the bird brain called HVC, and they tell me not to interpret these letters, so I don't want to interpret them, it's just a name. An acro for forgotten what it means, new or something like that. So that's the timing generator. At least it is the timing generator, maybe something else. It then provides the timing for this, which is more the generator of the song, and there the song memory more likely is, and so on. And then there's other areas. So we started out. So one theory, okay, so how do you generate precise timing in the brain? Maybe there are little atomic clocks somewhere in the nucleus. Probably not. So one way to generate precise timing is to use a physiological mechanism that is, if you want, that in itself has produces very precise timing, like the traveling of axons along the action potential along the axons, or the synaptic delays. And that's very simple. You just take one cell connected to the next and to the next, and you have a chain of axons, of cells, that then are simply the propagation delay. You have a delay line, if you want, a cellular delay line. And so one, the idea was that these cells that actually make the sparse timing code, which you can see sort of a diagram here, are actually sort of set up in chains in HVC, and sort of just excite the beginning of this chain, and then something propagates down this chain. Now, for this to be true, these cells have to be connected, or at least the connectivity between it has to be high enough. And so people had a little trouble finding these connections with electrophysiology. and it'll become clear why that is so. So, and then we did an experiment, or I should say, the people, when Jürgen Konfeld together with Mike Long's lab at NYU did this experiment, and it's, in some sense they did something that I always have abhorred, which is stain certain cells in a specific way. Because I always say, okay, you don't need to stain the cells. If you have a large enough volume, you basically just trace them, and then you have to sort of virtually stain them. And staining them sort of makes this experiment specific and it throws out a lot of the advantages. But anyway, they stain them, in some sense, without asking, which is a good thing. So now the other reason to stain them is if you want to look at cells, if you want to be sure you're looking at only the cells that project here, stain them by retrograde labeling from this here. You know that all the labeled cells in here are basically projected here. And so even if you use a relatively small volume, you can identify the cells by the fact that they're stained. And so, to make a long story short, I should go to the next slide. Because this only. So, they found. That, and at first it was puzzling, because at first we thought, okay, this problem, there is really a problem because they are not connected to each other. Because if you look, take a soma in this volume, the small volume that's now off the screen, and look at which other cell types it connects to, you'll find it connects mostly to inhibitory interneurons. There's maybe one other exception for that. That's not what we expected, because we wanted them to be connected to other timing cells, or excitatory cells. And so then we looked at orphans. So the problem, of course, if you have this, the distance from the soma that you can look at is limited, because there's a volume that constrains it. Now, because if you look at orphans that are also stained, because they have been retroactively stained. But of course, you don't have that soma. You see that those orphans, which you know are the same cell type because they're stained, they often connect and much more frequently connect to other excitatory cells. So if you and you can actually now you can use information from light microscopy, the fact that the branch density, which you can measure locally, increases or decreases with distance. This is far away from the soma, close to the soma. And so the connectivity onto excitatory cells increases, and the connectivity onto inhibitory cells decreases as you go away from the soma. So we do have the necessary connections for this chain, but they're sorted along the soma. Now comes the theorist in us. Sort of the.
But you're looking. Sorry, the block was what? It was
100 microns. Something like 100 microns.
Yeah, and the delay times that came out of the original paper from Michael's lab were on the order of sort of 100 milliseconds. That was on the figure that you showed two slides earlier. So that's a pretty long time, right?
Yeah, but okay. So first of all, you will see that. There are a few local connections. Most of the connections are long distances, sort of more half a millimeter.
But you kind of expect things like what do you expect, sort of a millimeter?
No, I think if I remember this right, so the song is about like the motif is of a second or so long,
yeah.
And it's divided into a set of 100 pieces, so you expect about 10 millisecond delay. So this is all consistent. That's not unreasonable. I mean, that consistency you can check. That doesn't depend on these results.
Okay.
So because if that hadn't been consistent, then you could have ruled out that model on other grounds.
When you say pieces are 10 milliseconds long, what's a piece?
Okay. So there's this idea that the question is. It's not. That's actually not known if they're discrete groups. But so you could have So you could say if you make a matrix so of where you order all the neurons according to their when they fire and so on. Then the question is, which other neurons do they connect to in this matrix? Do they connect to neurons that fire a millisecond apart, or sort of? And it looks like they connect to neurons that are sort of on the order of something like 10 milliseconds apart. Because if that's the time, otherwise they couldn't causally drive them, because there's the synaptic delay and the propagation delay. So and that defines if you want a time slice, but that doesn't mean that there are actually discrete groups that drive each other. It could still be a sliding continuum of activation times, but there's sort of the time delay between the most highly connected cells would then be 10 milliseconds or so.
And the song itself might not be broken up into 10 milliseconds, but
no, no, no. But the song at that point, the timing chain, as far as we know, is the continuous. That has nothing to do. So the breaking up of the song into individual motifs, then you go from one chain to the next one. But within this one motif, it looks like there's a continuous timing chain. So, but back to this image. So this is how the picture now looks like. So you have basically long. You force the connections to be long distance. Excitatory connection. It has two advantages. First of all, it gives you longer delays in the axon. And it also prevents to have local sort of hotspots, because the cells will, because they will have the tendency to talk to their neighbors most. And if they do that, you would very easily form a group of cells that is, if you want, a cell, whatever, cluster, a sort of, okay, you could call it sort of an epileptic focus if you want. Something that is very excitable and would feed sort of excitation to itself. And so for that, you actually want to prevent connections that are local. Now, if you actually, and so this may be an essential part of this. So the interneurons, in some sense, prevent a sort of a runaway local excitation. And now the next question is, how does this actually evolve? Or develop, not evolve. So if you simply put these cells there, the interneurons, once there's a little bit of connectivity here, this cell will actually prevent, if one of these cells fires, it will trigger the interneuron, this will trigger this cell. So if there was a connection between here and here, because you prevent the sequential firing of this, this actually prevents or weakens a synapse that exists between these. So that the run-of-the-mill Hebbian rules actually give you this connectivity.
So Winfried, so the inhibitory connections were seen to be in the reconstructions.
Yeah, you see those in the inhibitory connections.
And
they're also seen in the active physiology, so there was never a doubt that there are these connections.
But in this feed forward network, I mean, it's like all those SIDFIRE changes.
Yes.
I mean, you also don't want to get a. You also want to keep the pulse traveling one width, right? You don't want this version. On and on. So is this basically a pulse shaping circuit? This feedback between excitation and inhibition.
It could serve as that too. I'm not sure that. I'm not aware, but it would presumably also do that. But I would suspect that the whole, even without that, it probably has a tendency to, because of the superlinearity of action potential generation, sort of if any connection that is outside the pulse or at the marginals of the pulse would always be weakened anyway, because it would fire. So because what happens is once the chain is established and you have sort of a sort of a rogue connection, it will be synchronously act, sort of the cells will act in synchrony, but with a time delay that sort of puts them into the pulse, how is it, the spike timing dependent plasticity window, where it gets strengthened, would be, you fall out of it, then it would in fact be vehicle. So that alone gives you a sharpening of the timing. You don't actually need the inhibitory connections, but for preventing the local clusters, I think you do. So now, let me return to computers, or computer scientists, to our friends. So the thing that has happened, and I'm happy to report without my doing, I just was waiting for it to happen. So it's like the couple of days before Christmas, you wait for time to go by and somebody else to do some work for you. And that's what happened. So the problem was that, as I said, when we started this, we had the reconstruction of it good enough to give us sort of local puffing up or filling out of dendrites. We still had to look at basically every process from beginning to end, or had somebody look at, put the dendrites and the skeletons, and that's tedious, expensive, and so on. And so it limited the volumes that I could practically look at. So for the retina construction, the local connectome, we spent about something like between 300,000 and 500,000 euros on salaries for undergraduates. So
you could have financed Greece.
Pardon?
You could have financed Greece.
I think you don't understand the scale of the problem.
Possibly a problem.
Yeah. Okay. So now, fortunately, our long-time collaboration, which emerged from the collaboration with Sebastian Sung's lab, because one of his graduate students, Wilhelm Jane, went to Google, and we continued to be nice to him. Because he figured it will pay off at some point. And so we gave him an early data set, and they used that to develop their methods called the flood filling networks. And so here you just two of their snapshots. And so then after I saw this image, I said, okay, now I'm going to jump on this bandwagon, or jump back on this bandwagon, because this looks really interesting. So the next curve basically gives you the same thing as there, some run length measure. And so this has now gotten long enough, not so that there are no errors, but it's so and that you can use, you don't have to look at everything. You basically say, okay, things that look like ends, let's look at them. So this allows us to, and here are the actors responsible, is Viren in the lower image, and Michal Januszewski in the upper, who is the first R of the paper that just came out in Nature Methods. And now, is this movie running? Okay, it's not running. Okay. So this is, again, it's basically, convolutional neural network. Convoluted neural network, but it has a feedback loop in itself, and it basically does one process at a time, and that somehow conspires to make this very effective in getting these processes. And so the other part of the thing, of course, is the synapse detection, and again, this was done by, and I was really, it was done in my department, but not under my supervision, if anybody ever works under my supervision. I mean, I just provided the resources, basically, it's Jürgen Kornfeld's paper. And they developed machine learning-based synapse detection mechanism, which works pretty well, which we're now using to look at a different volume, now at a volume from area X. Now we'll talk about area X in a moment. So, now these are the synapses, all the detected synapses in a volume of area X. I think these are what are these are pixels, it doesn't really matter.
Wait, this is area X going back to the bird.
You're going back to the bird. We have never, I guess, we have never left the bird. I don't know, these pixels probably, it's again 100, this is 100 microns or so, or a small volume. Now, if I only, these are all, this is like 500 thousand synapses detected by this mechanism. And I think the size is at this point. So now if I take all the synapses that belong to one particular cell, and these are dendritic synapses, these are axonal synapses. So now we have a volume where we have all the processes, we have all the synapses, and now we can try to understand this. Now the reason why we're interested in area X, and let's actually jump a little bit, is the following. So area X is necessary for learning, but not for performing. So if you take area X out in a song, in a bird, that it has a fully developed song, it will continue singing that song. But it can no longer change that song or update it. So it just does whatever it has learned at some point. So, and if you take it out, but it will not learn, if you take it out in a young bird, it will not learn every song. And the other thing is, it has a place, this in area X, where all the necessary ingredients are nearby to learn by this reinforcement learning. So it has the so-called medium spiny neurons, which by way of a double inhibition and by going through noise generator, which we are the noise and other generator, can actually affect song generation. This RA is the area where the premotor, if you want, area that then controls the syrinx, which is sort of the part that actually creates this, modulates the airflow and modulates the song. That's where the muscles, or where neuronal signals are turned into actual sound. So now I said the noise generator, so that's important. So the song, if you listen very carefully to these songs, and if there is a song that is sort of the song that you sing in the shower or so, the song that you sing, the bird sings without, there's no female present. It will have some fluctuations in the song, in the parameters of this. The pitch will vary a little bit and so on, which has to be distinguished from that so-called undirected song. It's still very close. It's very similar to what's called the directed song, which doesn't have these fluctuations. And the way that it is thought to work is that this generates noise, which then generates variations in muscle activation, which generates the variations in the pitch and so on. And so, and at the same time, the information about what has been done, so that is in the form of an inference copy sent to this location. And now, this is a timing signal. So it, now you can correlate what has been done, so the disturbance, with a timing signal. And this gives you what happened then. This gives you something like the quality of life signals. Has life gone better or worse? You always need to know whether what you did was helpful or not. So that lets you then assign credit if you want. I mean, not immediately, maybe. You maybe may have some local storage of that, but this lets you figure out whether the fluctuation that you had was a good thing or not. Now, if it was a good thing, then you say, okay, let's strengthen the synapse. Now, next time we're activating, and this strengthening actually doesn't require the activation of this, and I'll get to that in a moment. But next time this timing comes around, even if this isn't here, or this isn't here, we will have a signal here, which will drive the noise generated in there. Here, as importantly, this loop has to be reasonably precisely closed. Then I can drive the song. And it actually turns out, if you teach the song with this so-called noise burst technique to raise the pitch of one of its harmonic stacks, then on the day you teach the bird to do that, if you then get rid of this area, it will revert to the old song. But if you wait for a day or two, then the information will somehow migrate from here to here, and then this is ready to learn the next thing. So it's an incremental learner and it's temporary, it's storage of temporary information. Now, why is this interesting from a point of view of electron microscopy? So here, now, this synapse is drawn as touching the, let me see, I have a bit of a better, should be here. So we now have a blow up of this. So this basically is a signal that is specific locally, but it basically says, okay, this particular muscle group was activated, which it turns out the muscle groups are mapped. There's a topological mapping of the muscle groups, because alone from the fact that the medium spinal neurons are coupled to a certain muscle group. But now I have to make sure that there's only one spine here drawn, but there could be another spine over that has a completely different timing signal. And so if you want to have this muscle group activated at a particular time, you don't want there to be crosstalk between different spines. So if you had these spines here, first of all, on the shaft, there would be a chance of crosstalk. So you would predict that the lines that come from HVC sit on spines and these sit on shafts. And you can all sit on spines, but you want these two. This is sort of the back standing for the back propagating action potential. It's the global signal. And then of course you want somewhere here to be the dopamine spritzers, so the VTA signals from VTA. And it looks like that's what we have, or will have. And so this is the preliminary results here. So spine heads, HVC, L9 on the shaft. Anyway. So now moving from finch to fish, staying with zebra. Fumi Kubo, who was in postdoc in Herwig Bayer's lab, and Fabian Suara, who was in my lab, or actually in Johann Bollmann's lab more. We shared him as a postdoc, as a graduate student. He's now moved on to Kevin Brickman's lab. So I will say a little about that story, partly because I know too little about it. But anyway, it's basically the problem of how the fish distinguishes this motion from, say, this motion. Rotation from translation. Important thing, and it requires information to pass from one side to the other, because you can't. The rotation is from translation is distinguished by in one case the motion being in the same direction in both eyes, in the other case in different directions. And so, again, there is some calcium imaging, seems to be the fashionable thing to do. Then the same animal embedded and X-rayed. Now the X-raying is important because it gives us a coarse alignment thing, which we need for fast imaging. And here
it's a little fast. So in this case, you're also recording from specific cells, and you're going to map those specific cells back into the image, like you did with the retina data.
Yeah, I figured that has sunk in by now.
It's not quite embedded, right?
Yeah, but you do remember it, do you? If not, I have a... I mean, anyway, so this is the status of this project. it's very colorful. This is sort of like a transition thing. I don't have any results here, but it sort of goes from a very local to, this is now a much bigger block because it's hundreds of microns, but still with the resolution of individual cells. Now to the crazy part. And I could stop here. And if I was reasonable, somebody would stop me here. And let me, but by popular demand, by populist demand, I will continue only briefly. So can we go on from C. elegans to the fly and then go to the elephant or to the mouse? And the problem with this project is that it's not obviously impossible. So we might be tempted. And what else are we going to do? So I will, in fact, stop here. And if you ask me about specific things, we have some ideas of how that could work. But we have no results, no concrete results. And I will leave this a mystery.
So early on, you sort of left out a point. You said that the best technique now is to use cold ion beam. You can cut down to about 5 nanometers. A fine axon resolution was required, but then the field of view was limited. And then what? It bears on your mouse.
Okay. If you force me to. You all are okay, so what we do is we do this. No, okay. Let's do this. Okay, we use it's knives to snowballs. It's not quite snowballs, it's knives to argon balls. So it turns out that if you make clusters of argon ions, sort of a couple thousand atoms, and charge them lightly, but then accelerate them to energies of tens of kilovolts, or 10 kilovolts, say, which still is only a few electron volts per atom. They will give you something that, even if directed, let's say, to 30 degrees down onto a surface, it will give you smooth surfaces. Now, the mechanism, I don't completely understand. This is up there, the Maria Komacheva is a graduate student working on this. If you get a smooth surface. Now, this is not, and in fact, we would have not started this if this work hadn't appeared, or if I hadn't heard about this work. So we go here. Okay. So Ken Haworth, was the one who came up with the atom, and then moved to Genelia from Harvard, and now is working on things like this. And so one thing he did, he developed something that. You remember there was this problem with the field of view. So there's two ways to solve this problem. So or the one way to solve this problem is if you can divide your brain into pieces in a way that doesn't lose your information. Because if you say do the obvious seeming thing is like vibratome the brain before embedding it, then you can reconstruct each of these slices, but then there's no way to get from one slice to the next one because you can't follow the thin process because the surface damage and so on. Now, there's no real proof that statement is true, but it seems very plausible, and I, certainly nobody has done it. So we'll take it as very likely. So, but if you now take the embedded brain and somehow cut it apart, now if you take a circular saw, that won't work, because that will leave you sort of at least a millimeter or two of gap, and then you have to be very, very, you need to guess what happens in a millimeter or two of neural pilin. There's just no way to do this. But if you use a diamond knife, you can cut sections. Now you say, okay, so that we have heard this all again, but you cut sections that are pretty thick, up to 20 microns. So 1,000 times thicker than what we remove in each cut of the serial block phase microscope. And then, section not to break, you have to heat it a little bit so it elastically deforms rather than breaking at the point where the knife sort of pushes it, lifts it off from the surface. So this is called the hot knife technique. Then you have, say sheets of stuff that is 20 microns thick. Now you still have to cut it in the other direction for it to use it in the FIPSIM, which you have to say the other direction is small. So that's what they're actually using. And there's another paper which I can, let's just tell you the story, which is what Janelia is using right now to make a whole brain volume of Drosophila. Now, why do they need another whole brain volume? Now they have the volume done with this with the transmission electron microscope. The reason is that's not really good enough to follow all the processes. I mean, you can learn a lot from it, but not everything. Now, in order to have the volume that is the absolute truth, the gospel, the thing that will end all, now anyway, will give you a very highly reliable connectome of the fly, you have to do this with the FIP, or maybe with this technique eventually. And so that's what they're doing right now. So we'll have a connectome in 2 years or so of the fly brain. It really has every connection. But now the question, that technique is works at that size. Now how do we actually use this for the next size up? And so this is now, you use this fact that you can cut the brain into sections about 20 microns or thick, and then combine this with the snowball machine, with the gas cluster machine, which can remove sort of whatever little, however little you want. You can remove 4 nanometer or 8 or something like that. And then, but do this in a way that there's still the whole, you still have the whole cross section of a whole brain, could be a whole mouse brain. So then you image that, and you do this in whatever 1,000 sections, and then you go to the next large section that you have cut off the brain, next 5 to 20 micron section. And so after 500 or so sections, you're through a whole mouse brain of the big sections. And so then you need something that can image fast. Now, first of all, at this point, you're already at a point where this can be paralyzed, because now you have 500 sections which you could send to 500 different scanning electron microscopes, or you can employ a multi-beam microscope, and I don't think I have time to talk about that, but that's also by now everybody's heard about this, which is a scanning electron microscope that gives you about 2 gigahertz of effective pixel rate, and then you buy 20 or 50 of those, or 10 or 20 of those, and then after 5 years you may have a whole mouse brain at a resolution that's good enough so you get almost no errors using, say, the flood film networks or something of that sort as the automatic reconstruction, and then you're done. No, not done, but then you have a mouse brain connectome, and then you can, then all the theorists can come in and test their theories, and I don't know. And then you go on to read, do whatever crazy thing we think about then. Okay, so let me end on this, and thank you for your superhuman or transhuman patience.
Sorry, Winfried, I realize this was the speculative part at the end, but I have this picture of taking something which is, let's say, of centimeter size, you slice it into 10 or 20 micron things, and you're telling me you can make your way through each 10 or 20 microns at 4 nanometer resolution.
Yeah.
But you also told us somewhere near the beginning that there's a problem of field of view, that you know, if I give you a whole centimeter square, then shaving away difficult, and somehow this is solved with the ion clusters, or
yeah, it's solved with the ion clusters, because now with the focus ion beam, you have to, in the direction of the ion beam, which is either in X or Y or is in the plane, you can have only say 20 or 60 microns or something like that. And now in this case, that dimension becomes as large as you need.
Okay.
You flip the section.
And sometimes you do flip the hot knife section, is correct. In the flip case, the hot knife section is like this, and you have to recut it with something which is also a non-trivial problem. And then you could do the focused ion beam like this, and then image from this side. Now with the gas cluster ion, you take the section, the 20 micron section like this, you gas cluster it, and then put it in a microscope, you do it in a multi-beam, go back in the gas cluster, multi-beam, gas cluster, multi-beam, and so on.
Would that slow things down a lot, to have to go back and forth between two devices?
Not really, because it takes actually quite a bit of time to scan a full field cross-section of the mouse brain. So the transfer times are not very significant. I mean, the other thing is you can, even though the milling takes time, you can sort of swap wafers. Because you can do the milling while, and so it's that. And if the milling is fast, you can make one machine that makes that cuts the wafers, and you have a bunch of multi beams or whatever you have by that time.
Okay, so we snack went pretty good.